Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Putting It Together. It's my holiday retreat episode, and I'm saying this from my wee studio, but knowing that it will come to you when I'm actually out of the country doing my thing. So, I'm here, but I'm not really here. Isn't that weird? Anyway, I'm excited to bring you another episode, and this week my guest is the actor Peter Forbes, and it's a tremendous honour to have Peter on the show. Some of you will have seen him in Follies recently. He played the part of Buddy in the new National Theatre production of the musical Follies, and I have to say, I've never seen a musical done like that. I've never experienced a musical in that way. Such a unique production. I mean, beautiful music and an amazing piece on paper, I can only imagine, but the way it was done was really astounding. And to see somebody, you know, I've worked with Peter before, and I was really literally on the edge of my seat watching him do his thing. So I would urge you, if you do get a chance, if you've not seen it, to see one of the reruns of the NT Live production of Follies. And it's great because Pete talks us through a wee bit of what that was like, what, you know, the process of that was, but also coming to get the job, the various rigorous stages of auditioning, waiting to hear if Mr. Sondheim approved, you know, amazing. Even sentences that you never think will leave your mouth, like Mr. Sondheim approves, being a real thing you can actually say to apply to your own career. It's tremendous. So, what a joy to have Peter talk to me. We did that in the Lyceum, in the little sound booth upstairs in the Lyceum, because I managed to catch him in Edinburgh when he was up for a very short time. That's what I'm doing. I'm sometimes just packing everything up and running to another city to get the opportunity to speak to somebody, to grab the chance while I can. Happy to do it, and it was amazing. I know Pete for a wee while, and it's nice to, I mean, I've chatted to him loads, and he's done a lot of really interesting work. But it's sometimes nice with this, what I'm doing, to sit down and kind of shut everything else off and take away all the other chat and just say, let's really get into that. Let's really focus on your process and what you've done. And I don't really, it's not like standing at the side of a rehearsal room where you exchange anecdotes. It is a wee bit more, okay, this is your turn, let me just hear all about that, and I just get to sit back and listen to it and enjoy it. It's amazing for me, and I'm trying to just bring that to you and let you enjoy it too. So this week, that is my treat, to bring you Peter Forbes in all his glory. And he does this great voiceover work as well, which is so cool because it's something that I'm aspiring to be involved in. He's doing all the audiobooks of Peter May's books, and he's doing them gradually, and he tells us a wee bit about how that is too. Anyway, it's very late here when I'm recording this, and I'm trying, I don't know if you notice me trying not to speak too loud because maybe my neighbours are asleep. I don't know, but I mean, I could be on the phone. Who cares? I've just come back from the Traverse Theatre. I've been seeing Mark Thomas's new show, Showtime from the Frontline, and I have to say I was really blown away by it. And I don't say that often. I do say things are good, things are great, but this really reaffirmed my love for theatre and for art. And it made me, at the very end, the first thing I said was, that's what it's all about. And it's hard to explain. It's not about me explaining what it was about, but my experience was it was reaffirming why I believe in theatre, why I believe in the power of art, and indeed the power of comedy. So what he did was he ran a comedy workshop in Palestine where stand-up comedy as a form doesn't really exist, and he found people who wanted to be comics and who thought that they were funny, and he ran this workshop and put on a gig. And the results are kind of portrayed in this piece of storytelling, which is, it's largely him doing what he does, which is this direct address to the audience, great storytelling, stand-up stuff. But in this case, for the first time, he's brought along two other comics, and they're two of the guys who attended the workshop, who did their first gig at the end of that workshop. And we see some of that reenacted, but we see other interactions with them telling some of the broader political story of what's going on there, the fact that they were brought up there in refugee camps. Amazing, amazing stuff. And in completely non-patronising way, I learned so much. It taught me so much in a non-patronising way. It was brilliant. I'm fired up even just talking about it, and I'm so glad I saw it. And it's not yet in Glasgow, so this is one of those times where I'm mentioning something and it's not actually over. You've got a chance to go and see it. It's coming to the Tron in Glasgow very soon, so do look out for details of that. It's called Showtime from the Frontline. Anyway, enough chat from me because it's time for me to chat to Peter Forbes. So here we are together, putting it together.
I did think about staying up a bit longer, but I had things to get back for, so...
So you're starting another thing down south now?
Well, I'm doing something next, so I'm recording an audiobook.
Oh, the old Peter May.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be the last one for a wee while, but it's been very handy, because I think I've done 5 or 6 over the last few months.
Really? That many?
In between performances of Follies at the National and all
yes.
that jazz.
That was a fair wee run at that.
It was.
How long were you in that
then? Including rehearsals, I'd say the whole thing was about 6 months.
Gosh.
So it was a long rehearsal period, as you can imagine.
Luxurious, though.
Yes.
Long enough to be luxurious.
Long enough to be pretty luxurious,
that's
yes.
That's nice. That's good.
And, you know, because it was such a big show and we had a revolve and all the rest of it, one of the joys of rehearsing at the National is they have a rehearsal room with a revolve.
Oh, yeah.
So that was all good. And, I think we had about 9 weeks in the rehearsal room before we went
That's
into
good.
Tech. And
But it's a big learn, that part.
Yeah, it's all... I mean, it's a big show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's huge. The original production had a cast of 51.
51.
And 28 musicians. Ah.
Wow. Those were the days.
Those were the days. But we didn't do too badly. We had 37 in the cast.
That's hefty.
And 21 musicians.
Tremendous.
The MD. So that was quite an experience, singing with that bunch.
Yeah, that's gorgeous.
Behind you. It was really great.
And then there's something about it being all in one act that means that the process is different because you have to sustain things in a different way.
Yes, but it makes it easier in a way. I mean, the just for anybody who doesn't know, the evening is a reunion mm-hmm. of people who've performed in the Follies. Between the wars, 1918 to 1941, when Pearl Harbor happened and it all finished. And it's one of those nights where the time passes without anybody really realizing how far through the night they are. So
right.
There's a kind of relentless drive through the evening to what with a number of revelations taking place.
Yeah.
And that sense of, you know, being at a reunion party at maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, having had a bit too much to drink,
mm-hmm.
where you get so tired and emotionally perturbed that you start to almost hallucinate, sort of only really makes sense if you do the whole evening in one go. If you had an interval, there's nowhere really to put it.
You're trying to pick back up in that.
Yeah, exactly.
With that sense.
So the audience are with it all the way through. And,
yeah.
You know, I never really knew when we were doing it whether some people said that was wonderful. Hardly anybody said we didn't like that. I actually got to see a screening a couple of weeks after I'd finished.
The rerun of
NT Live, yeah, which was a bit weird watching through your fingers at times.
Oh,
and,
God.
But it was extraordinary, that sense of the momentum of the evening and the relentlessness of the evening emotionally for an audience. It was remarkable.
The difference between where it starts out and where it ends up is such a trajectory, isn't it? That to keep it going
right.
in one go is it's really powerful.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And it's what they did originally when they did it in, well, they tried it out in Boston in 1971 and then took it on to Broadway. And all through the period when they were rehearsing in Boston and previewing, they tried putting an interval in various places and it never really quite worked. So in the end, they just said, no, we've got to bite the bullet and just do the whole thing in a wanna.
Which presumably wasn't a done thing.
Not a very normal thing to do at all with a musical, especially in a commercial, big commercial theatre. You know, managements always want that
they
money
want
coming
the intro,
over the bar.
Yeah.
So whether it's on Broadway or the West End or indeed at the National Theatre, although they were absolutely, you know, on board with it and, you know, didn't say, oh no, we can't afford to lose the bar takings as some theatres might.
No, yeah.
But again, that's the luxury of being at the National.
Well, that's it. Yeah. There's a lot of luxuries.
There are.
Isn't it? But you've been there a few times, so it's nice to be back. And
lovely to be back.
Is there a feeling of coming home? Do you feel you have a home there?
I don't want to be presumptuous, but
no.
But I do. I've always loved that theatre. Mm-hmm. I guess going right back to when I finally owned up to myself and my family and everybody else that that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
One of the key things that happened was I spent a summer in London. I can't remember if it was between school and university or when I was already at university. But my uncle was an architect and he had a worked for a big practice in London just off Tottenham Court Road. And he was a great lover of theatre as well. And I came down and spent the summer working in his office, which was an interesting experience, in the library with a man who was the librarian, but who was also a Satanist. But that's another story, which we might or might not get
into.
Did
he try and recruit you?
No, no, he didn't at all. He was a really interesting guy. But yeah, so maybe two or three times a week, we'd finish work in the office and my uncle would come and get me and say, right, come on, we're off to the theatre.
Oh.
And a lot of the theatre I saw that summer was things at the Nash. I saw Death of a Salesman in the Littleton with Warren Mitchell playing Willie Loman.
Yeah.
And the wonderful Doreen Mantle as his wife. And I saw Paul Scofield in Othello with... Michael Bryant. I also saw that week, in almost the same, the next night, I saw Donald Sinden as Othello for the RSC with the wonderful Bob Peck as Iago.
So two Othellos in one
two
week?
Two Othellos in one week.
You weren't messing about, were you?
No,
and
no,
Death
no.
of the Salesman.
Man. Yeah, yeah. Saw Noises Off. Sort of, what else did I see? All
I
sorts
love
of
noises
things.
Off.
We went to loads and loads of plays and musicals and stuff. And but I remember my experience of going in and out of the National Theatre on the South Bank was just... It was kind of formative. I always thought that's where I want to aim for.
Okay.
I want to be part of that company. And it took a wee while, but I got there.
These things do, though,
they
quite
do.
Often.
They can.
You put the work in.
And actually, the longer it takes, the more you appreciate it when you do get there, which is nice.
So do you mean to say that summer when you saw the theatre, you finally conceded to yourself that actually this is what you want to do as opposed to...
Well, it sort of opened things up for me in a way because I was... You know, I'd always performed a wee bit as a kid, as lots of us do, mainly through choirs and doing shows at school. But I never went to a school that had a drama department.
Yeah, same.
Unheard of.
Yeah.
And there was one English teacher who ran a drama group for, I think, up to the third year. And I, when I was in my fifth year, went to her and said, Miss, could we not start a drama group for fourth, fifth and sixth year?
Mm-hmm.
And she went, oh, I haven't got time to do that.
And I went up to third year. That's a strange decision, isn't it?
So, well, it was all a bit odd. There was a lot of internal politics, I think. And so, actually, the people who mostly encouraged an interest in drama and theatre going and cinema going were a group of younger teachers who lived up in what we called the huts or the porter cabins on the playing fields, as a lot of schools, as they got bigger, just expanded onto playing fields and stuff. And that was the Geography, History and Modern Studies department up there.
Right.
And they were younger teachers who were into all sorts of things. And they would organise trips to go and see, you know, we went to see Annie Hall or something at the Cameo and in Edinburgh. And that was very bold, you know, taking school pupils to the cinema. We came to see a couple of plays at the Lyceum. Until the head of English said, this is outrageous. The history department shouldn't be taking people on theatre trips. So the head of history said, well,
who
that's
else?
Fine. You can take them.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, no, we can't do that. So there was a kind of blanket sort of apathy, suppression of enthusiasm going on. Anyway, that was the thing. But we did do, you know, there would be a school show every 2 years or whatever. It'd be a Gilbert and Sullivan or a light opera or something. So that was kind of a formative thing. I remember doing the Pirates of Penzance in the Carnegie Hall in Dunfermline.
Tremendous. Love the Pirates of Penzance.
Yeah.
Love
the
Pirates.
And that was great. That was great fun. And then I went to university and that's where I really started acting because there was the University Theatre Company in Edinburgh. We took over the Bedlam on George IV Bridge and we ran that and it was, you know, we could do whatever we wanted. So you'd do several shows a term, you know, lunchtime things or...
Yeah.
Sometimes bigger productions. And so I was already beginning to think, I quite like this. I think this might be something I want to do. But not coming from a theatre background, you think, well, how does that happen? How do you get into doing that for a living?
Yeah, yeah.
Is
that even possible?
Exactly.
You have that thing. Do people do that?
Yeah.
Not a hobby?
Exactly. So I thought, well, there were a couple of older students in the years above me who had gone off to do postgrad courses or whatever. So I only knew about two postgrad courses, one at Webber Douglas and one at Bristol. And I ended up going to Bristol for 2 years. And that was me kind of on the way. But even then, I was, I remember thinking, well, if I can get into a good drama school, I'll go to drama school. And if I don't get in, I won't. I'll do something else. I'll go and be a teacher or whatever.
Right.
And then I thought when I was at drama school, I thought, well, that's fine. If I get a job when I finish, I'll carry on and do it. And if not, I'll maybe have to go and do something else.
Okay. That's your attitude?
Yeah. I thought, well, I sort of made that my attitude. It wasn't really my attitude, but that was how I rationalized it to myself.
Okay, yeah.
And lo and behold, before I finished my second year, I went for an audition and got a job and left 2 weeks early and started. I thought, oh, this is fine. I'll go and do this. And then the end of that job, I'll just see what happens.
If I get one, I get one.
And I'll get another one, I'll carry on. So I've just been carrying on, basically.
So is that still the thing? Do you just go, well, you know, if I get another one, I get another one?
Well, no, I wouldn't say I was quite as sanguine about it as that now. But I sort of feel that's kind of... I always had this idea, really, that you're only an actor when you're acting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not acting, you know, you can't really call yourself an actor, which is ludicrous because there's lots of actors who are acting some of the time and not at other times, including me. And you reach a point maybe where you've got a critical mass mm-hmm. of experience behind you and you go, no, it's all right to say I'm an actor now.
It really is what I do.
It is what I do.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's a certain amount of self-protection involved in saying, well, yeah, this is what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out and I'll do something else.
Yeah.
Although God knows what I would have done. I mean, I haven't a clue. I wouldn't really have been happy teaching, I don't think. So I don't know where I would have ended up.
I can see you at the front of a schoolroom, though, giving it what for.
Maybe.
Giving people what for.
Yeah.
Do you know, funnily enough, one of the schools I went to in the huts were mm-hmm. classics, geography, modern studies, and one of the classics teachers led the anti-globalization group.
Really?
Yeah. And he later became a journalist and now he writes theatre reviews.
Oh, really?
And he was teaching at this private school that I went to for a year. So that's
it's all the
happens.
Departments that might be cut that are in the huts.
Yeah, they're all up the back and they're up to all...
They're
no one knows
the
what they're doing.
They're not the STEM subjects. They're not the core subjects. Yeah.
All the humanity. So did you, when you, to go back to Follies, got that job or started doing it, did you see it as a big light bulb moment of your career, a big important moment?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Without doubt.
Not just the next thing.
No, not at all. I mean, I was very flattered and astonished to be asked in for an audition. I had no idea until my agent rang and said, you've got an audition for Follies at the National.
They asked to see you?
Yes, Wendy Spawn, who's the head of casting,
yep.
who I know really well, and I've worked there obviously quite a bit, put me on the list and got me in. And actually, I think sort of championed me in a way, because I hadn't worked with a director before. I hadn't worked with a musical director or the musical supervisor. I'd never worked with the choreographer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was, you know, once I was cast in the show, I felt like I was the only... one of the four main principals that nobody had ever heard of. I think I was the only one without an Olivier Award.
Really?
So I kind of thought, why am I here? Why have they got me in for this?
Imposter syndrome,
definitely. And also, you know, I've done musicals, but I had always... The only Sondheim I had done before was... A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum at Regent's Park, which is a great show, but it's not really on the same level as Follies in terms of sophistication. Musically, Follies is much more complex.
It's one of his really earlier works as well.
Yeah.
And that is different.
Yeah.
That's marked.
So I remember turning up for the audition in the casting office at the National, and Wendy came in and she said, oh, hi, Peter, how are you? And I said, Wendy, I'm shitting myself. She said, what? I said, I'm really scared. And she said, why? And I said, well, A, I really want to get this job.
Yeah.
And B, it's not easy stuff. It's really hard. You know, they'd sent me a song to learn, The Right Girl, mm-hmm. which is Buddy's big number, and they had sent me a couple of scenes. So I went in and she said to them, Peter's very nervous. And I thought, oh, don't say that.
What, with you walking in?
Yeah.
Here's Peter, he's very nervous.
No. And they were lovely. They were really nice. And but I really did, you know, to answer your question, I went into that audition with an enormous sense of the significance of the project and, you know, what it would mean to get that job. And I've auditioned at the National lots of times and sometimes got the job and sometimes not. And it hasn't been the end of my world. But I kind of thought, if I don't get this, I'll be so disappointed. And if I do get it, I might explode with excitement.
Yeah.
So I went in, read, that was all fine, sang for Nick Skilbeck, the musical supervisor, who's brilliant. And
I worked with him when I was a kid.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Amazing guy, really amazing. Mm-hmm. And so that all went very well. Wendy said when I came out, oh, that was great, we'll get you in to meet the choreographer. It might take a wee while. A couple of weeks went by, went to meet Bill Dima, the choreographer. I had to learn another number, Buddy's Blues, which is a big fast folly at the end.
Oh, yeah.
And do some choreography. And so, oh, my God. Because I'm not really a dancer. But
you can move.
I can move. But so, yeah. And there was a, and Wendy was in the corner of the room with a camera. And I thought, oh, that must be for Dominic. Because Dominic, the director, wasn't there because he was filming. And we went through the number and that was all fine. We did a bit of choreography, fine, came out and said, now it might take a few weeks to sort all this out because they're all going off to various other projects. And so I was doing other things. I was doing a workshop for another musical, weirdly, an early Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. And we were presenting it to Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice.
What show was that?
It was a thing called The Likes of Us.
Oh, yeah, The Likes of Us.
The first thing that they wrote together, although they didn't actually write it together. Andrew, at the age of 19 or something, had written these songs. And an agent introduced him to Tim Rice and said, I think you should meet this guy. And Tim wrote the lyrics. And it's all about Dr. Barnardo's and how that started. And it was never a fully realised musical, really. It was a collection of songs. And Chris Luscombe and Malcolm McKee got together and wrote a book for it. And they did it at Andrew's Festival in Sydmonton one year as a tryout. And then they wanted to workshop it as a possible full production. So we did that. Anyway, I was doing that and thinking, oh, this is odd, isn't it? I'm suddenly in the world of musical theatre workshops and and it's all very nice. And we presented it and that was fine. And then I was travelling home on the bus because I thought I'm too skint to get the train because I hadn't after we finished in the James plays in Toronto I'd had a bit of a lean patch, so I was, you know, I was going up for stuff but I wasn't getting anything, and it, and you know, a few months had gone by and I'm thinking, oh God, it's November now, I don't suppose I'm ever going to hear about Follies now. And so I was feeling a bit down on my way home on the bus through Forest Hill in the rain, and
you paint quite a picture,
and my phone rang and it was one of those, and my phone rang, and it was my agent moments. Yeah. And she said, hi, Peter, how are you? I said, I'm fine. She said, I've got some news for you that I think you might quite like. And I said, oh, what is it? And she said, Wendy Spawn has just rung from the National Theatre to say that Stephen Sondheim has approved your casting as Buddy Plummer in the National Theatre's production of Follies.
Oh, wow.
I went, what? And she said, Stephen Sondheim. I said, yes, I heard that, but I said, how? And then I remembered Wendy with her camera in the corner of the room.
Yeah.
And obviously he'd seen the tape. And so I was just really excited. I felt like dancing a jig.
That is the pinnacle moment. It's because after that you have to do it.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what, because I got off the bus and the first thing I did was ring Wendy to say, Wendy, I'm so thrilled about this. And she said, so am I. She said, that's how I felt about getting the job of head of casting at the National. It was like, oh my God, this is a, you know, a real dream job.
Yeah.
She said, and then of course I realized you've got to do it now. And I said, well, that's exactly how I feel.
It's,
and of course, that was in November and we started rehearsals in June. So,
so you had all that time to think.
I had all that time to think and go to the gym and try and get fit and do all that. So that was, yeah, it was great. And then the whole rehearsal process was really remarkable. I mean, there was an incredible buzz in the building when we arrived to start rehearsals, for everybody, from the stage people at the stage door, you know, the people in the canteen, the crew, all going, yes, we're doing Follies, you know. It was really exciting. The whole team behind it. And Rufus Norris, the artistic director, who'd programmed it, of course. And that was, you know, the usual meet and greet of, you know, however many people in the room. Well, it was enormous. There must have been over 100 people in the room.
Wow.
And from that moment on, it was just an extraordinary experience, really. Surrounded by people working absolutely at the top of the game.
I mean,
that's what it felt like. And it felt like the stars aligned in terms of everything coming together. I mean, you and I know that when you work on a production, even if it's a great production, you sometimes think afterwards, oh, well, maybe if that had been slightly different. Or,
mostly,
you know,
that's
because nothing's ever perfect,
thing, isn't it?
And you know, there might have been odd things about Follies where you think maybe not, but actually, I never felt that. And even sitting in rehearsals, I'd come in and sit and wait for my scene or whatever, and watch what was going on the rehearsal floor, and just go, "Wow,
yeah,
wow, this is really special.
It's the best of the best.
It is."
You should look around, as you say, and everyone's at the top of their game.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
In every department, you know, the design, the sound design, the lighting design, the music. I mean, unbelievable.
Well, the thing about that is you put good stuff in, you get good stuff out. That music is brilliant on the page anyway.
It is.
And then you give it to really good musicians and great singers and performers. I mean,
yeah,
it's an amazing thing. I heard him say, I don't know if I heard him say, but I heard someone quote Sondheim as having said, "I'd rather cast an actor who can sing a bit than a singer who can act a bit."
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting.
Well, he does, because he's, I mean, you know, he's primarily a wordsmith. He's a lyricist.
Yeah.
And that's what he's interested in. He's interested in characters. He's interested in how they express themselves.
Yeah.
And his songs, it was actually, drop a wee name, Imelda Staunton said to me when we were in rehearsal, she said, of course...
Twang.
Sorry.
And
she said, of course, there aren't any songs in this show.
Mm.
They're all scenes. They just happen to be set to music. And she's absolutely right, because every number in the show, well, there are two, they say there are two types of numbers in Follies. There are what they call the pastiche numbers, like Broadway Baby, I'm Still Here, and those big numbers that we've all, to some extent, the Follies numbers as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mirror, Mirror is a pastiche number.
Yes.
And then there are what they call the book numbers, which are the songs that form the spine of the storytelling about the four key characters at the centre and their relationships to each other and to their younger selves. And so they are slightly different. They're very much Sondheimian, if you like. And the pastiche numbers are all based on very specific styles and even specific composers.
Yeah.
And even the prologue, you can hear, if you listen to the prologue, the overture at the beginning of the show, you can hear in the arrangements, if you know your history of the American songbook and those big bands and everything, you can hear specific styles of Duke Ellington, Glenn Miller, you know, basic, whatever, Woody
Herman.
There's
Herman. There's all over the place.
Very specific nods. I mean, I think there are even notes in on the musicians' pads, particularly the reed players, where it'll just say Ellington Swing at the top. So amazing. They know exactly what the style is. And it's a love song in that sense. It's a love letter to that period of American music in theatrical entertainment, if you like. And we had the absolute joy of having, not only did Stephen come to the first two previews, but we had Jonathan Tunick.
Oh, yes.
Who was the original orchestrator and who had orchestrated everything from Company in 1970 right up to the present day that Stephen has written. Plus, he's done loads of other stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing guy. I think he actually did some of the music for Columbo.
Really?
I think he did.
Oh, I see.
But he is an amazing man. I think he's 80 years old. He's lived in the same corner of New York, Manhattan, all his life. He now lives in an apartment which is two streets away from where his mother lived. And his whole musical life has been spent in New York. So he's just absorbed by osmosis. And he was a clarinetist and a reed player in big bands for a while. Before he got into composing and arranging. But he came over for all the band calls and he had reorchestrated down from 28 to 21 piece orchestra. And they had, I think, five band calls before we had what they call the sits probe, which, you know, is where we sing through for the first time with the orchestra, which is always one of the most exciting things about doing a musical.
It must have been just thrilling in this case.
It was brilliant. But also the night I had said to the music department, because my son Ewan plays double bass, he's 16, and is thinking about a career in music. So I'd said to Nick Skilbeck, the musical supervisor, would it be all right to bring him into the sits probe so he can just hear this band close up, you know? And he went, oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, but bring him into a band call because he'll learn more from a band call. So I took him into the last band call the night before the sits pro, and we walked in and Nigel, the MD, said, oh, Ewan. He said, can we get a chair for Ewan and just put it next to Steve, the bass player?
Yeah.
And Ewan was kind of, oh, no, it's all right, Dad, I'll just sit here with you. And I said, no, you won't. You'll go over and sit there. So he sat through the whole session next to the double bass player, watching as Jonathan would tweak the arrangements and, yeah, you know, they'd play through something and he'd go, oh, would you indulge me? Bar 1, 2, 3 of the third bar, cello, you have nothing in that chord, am I right? And she'd go, no, no, I'm not playing at all in that bar. Go, would you just give me the G above middle C and let's put it on the harp as well. Can I hear that? And oh, then they would play it and it would just very subtly change the texture,
yeah,
of the whole piece. And
what a brain. Oh, what an ear.
And what an ear. Amazing. I mean, obviously he knew what he'd written.
Yeah.
But also he was unearthing little mistakes he'd made and going, oh, I'm sorry about that. That should be an F sharp, not a, you know. And but just for Ewan to watch that whole process,
yep,
you know, was like, he was just blown away by it. Really amazing. And I had a lovely chat with Jonathan because I'm a bit of a jazz fan.
Yeah.
And I said to him, you know, you must have heard some extraordinary stuff in your life in New York. And I said, did you ever go to all the old jazz clubs, you know, when you were younger? And he said, oh, yeah, sure. He said, when I was a kid in college, he said, I used to go to the original Birdland. And he said they had these bleacher seats at the side of the stage and the kids could sit there. And he said, I always sat next to the piano. So he said, I've been this close to Count Basie and all these extraordinary mm-hmm. musicians. I said, did you ever see Charlie Parker there? And he went, oh, sure. He was a better improviser than he was a saxophonist. I was like, oh, really?
Wow.
And he said, yeah, yeah. He wasn't a great saxophonist, but boy, he was, you know, he could improvise. And, you know, that's as a reed player, you know, in terms of his tone and his everything mm-hmm. else, mm-hmm. he wasn't the most versatile, but he had this extraordinary gift. And, you know, he'd met all the Ellington Band and all those people. In fact, another jazz geeks story is that there was a great clarinet player called Jimmy Hamilton, who was Ellington's lead clarinet player. And when in 1971, when they did the first production of Follies, Jonathan got wind of the fact that Jimmy Hamilton was about to retire.
Mm.
And so he said to the producers, see if you can book Jimmy Hamilton to play first clarinet on Follies. And so he wrote it effectively, that part he wrote for Jimmy Hamilton. And they said, would you come and do it? And he went, well, no. And he wanted to go and retire and live with his family in Connecticut or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, nah, I don't think I will. Thanks, but no thanks. And he said, can you imagine if we'd had Jimmy Hamilton in that orchestra first album, cast album recording? Astonishing.
But he's to get to that position where you can just go, nah.
Nah, exactly. Yeah.
How about that?
I've seen it all, done it all. And actually,
I'd rather be in Connecticut.
I don't want to go and, you know, spend 2 months in Boston and then a year in.
What drag, man?
Yeah, exactly. Playing the same thing every night.
Yeah, who wants to do that?
But that's amazing. Yeah.
So it really did speak to you as this. It is a big moment.
Yeah, and it felt like, you know, it was extraordinarily privileged. You felt like, I mean, talking to people like Jonathan and of course Stephen, it's like you're touching greatness.
Yeah.
And
history.
Who knows how long we'll have them with us, you know, they're not young men.
And Sondheim is well into
his 80s. I think Steve's about 86. And he, you know, he may never see another production of Follies on that scale again. And he loved it. You know, he was amazing. He really supportive. And he, you know, you said about him liking actors. I mean, the thing he said about the production was, and I thought this was an extraordinary thing. He said to me, Peter, he said, it's the first time I've ever seen this show where I really knew who these characters were and why they were the way they are. Which, the man who was one of the people who wrote the show, I thought was an extraordinary thing to say.
It opened up for him.
Yeah, and he said, I give credit for that to Dominic Cook, the director, because he's come from the world of plays.
Yep.
As opposed to the world of musical. It was the first musical that Dominic's ever directed. I mean, he's directed big shows, but he's never done a musical before. And so we came, the whole rehearsal process, again, with the luxury of, you know, 9 weeks in the rehearsal room,
yeah,
we approached it as if it was a new play,
mm-hmm.
a new piece. And so we did lots of different types of rehearsal on it, where, so you ended up with all sorts of different options in performance, really. So mm-hmm. you felt that you were layering and layering and layering the characters and their relationships to each other. And
so it's all there when you step out. Everything's you've done the work, as they
absolutely,
say.
Absolutely, yeah.
So and before this, over the years, mm-hmm. we could talk about Follies for an hour, of course.
I know.
But have you done a lot of other new writing?
I have. I worked quite a lot for a period in, when was it now, about from 1987 to about 1995. So over about eight years, I worked a lot with Alan Ayckbourn.
That was right.
Who I mainly worked with. And I would go up and do a season every other year, I suppose, in his theatre in Scarborough,
mm-hmm.
The Stephen Joseph Theatre in the Round. And I do new plays of his. I do new plays by other people.
Under his direction
sometimes, yeah. And mostly
he directs his own work, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. I mean, he sort of always said that he was a director who wrote rather than a writer.
Yeah, I did read that.
And actually, the for me, the most extraordinary thing about him as a director, given that he is often the author as well, and that his plays, when you read them, well, when I read them, they just immediately project themselves onto your inner eye. I can see the characters, I can hear what they sound like. They are so precise, so clear.
Mm.
And but in rehearsals, he never plays the card of, look, I'm the author and this is why it's the way it is. He delivers the script to himself, I guess, and mm-hmm. his company, himself as director. And then you go into the rehearsal room and then you start doing it, and he sees what the actors bring to it, and then he works with that. And I said to him once, when you're casting, are you looking for a very specific person for each part? Do you know what they look like? Do you know what they sound like? And he said, no. And I said, really? And he said, no, I know who they are. But he said, there is a moment when an actor walks in and reads the part, and you go, that's him.
That must be difficult.
Which I think is really fascinating.
To have written it and to then not come in with this preconceived idea of.
Yeah. I mean, he knows who they are as a personality.
Sure.
And but he writes them with such specific speech rhythms and vocabulary that it makes you think, well, he must almost have done a very detailed character drawing of this person before he sat down to write it. But actually, he has a very good sense of them as a person.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't preempt what that. Because for him, writing is only part of the process. Writing is the first bit, and then you get in the rehearsal room and then you rehearse it. And then it's not fully realised until you put it in front of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it only really fully exists somewhere between the actors and the audience. And that, particularly working in the Round, that's very...
It's almost more true.
It's almost more true because the audience are always, to some extent, aware of the rest of the audience because they can see them on the other side of the stage. And they see... And you see each scene from your point of view. And then when you move around the other side, you suddenly see the scene from a different character's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's quite an interesting process as well. But yeah, he was brilliant to work with and brilliant. He's a brilliant director. I mean, a lot of people don't really think of him as a director because he's so well known as a writer.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I heard a story about him. Apparently, he was in the first ever production of Harold Pinter's The Birthday Party.
That's probably true.
As an actor, and said to Pinter, but before he comes to this place, you know, who is he? Where does he come from? I don't understand from reading the text. And Pinter apparently said to him, he comes from the fucking wings.
Yes, exactly.
He says the lines and he leaves. And that was his whole philosophy was, the words are on the page. You know,
exactly. And also in Pinter's plays, you don't really have a sense of what's outside the room.
No, it's so often that world in it.
Whereas in Alan's plays, you always have a sense of what's outside the room. There are characters in his plays who never appear, but they're referred to.
Yeah.
And you know, you have a very clear picture of who they are from other people's descriptions of them and so on, and their role in the story.
It's almost the opposite end of that scale, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
like
looking through two different ends of a telescope.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Wow. I heard also, I'm going into anecdote mode, that The Woman in Black was written by Stephen Maltrat, was adapted by Stephen Maltrat as a filler for a summer season at Stephen Joseph Theatre.
Well, I saw the very, very first performance of The Woman in Black.
No. So is that true then? It was a kind of a quick...
It was a late night show in the bar. Because they used to do, in the summer, there would be maybe three or four main house productions.
Mm.
But the company are there for the whole summer. And so you would be in maybe two of the main house shows, and you would do a lunchtime show, and you would do a late night show.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman in black was actually, was it a Christmas? I think it was on over Christmas.
Oh, was it?
And we were doing a kids show in the main house, a Ken Campbell play called Old King Cole. And they were doing the woman in black in what was known as the bistro, which was... The theatre was in an old school, so we were in what used to be the main hall, mm-hmm. as the main house. And at the other end of the building, effectively, there was a what would have been a smaller hall with the bar and the box office and everything in between. And that was a cafe during the day, and it was a bistro in the evenings. Mm-hmm. And then they would do the lunchtimes and late night shows in there. So, you know, the building got a lot of use. But so it was a very small room, long, narrow room. We were all jammed in, shoulder to shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, they had created, Michael Holt, the designer, had created this perfect little proscenium arch with curtains and everything.
Right.
And it was incredibly intimate and utterly terrifying,
mm.
because you were all in such close proximity. So yeah, it was just done as a late night show at Scarborough. And then it went, I think it went to the Lyric Hammersmith. And then eventually went into the West End, and you know, it's been there ever since.
It's funny the trajectories these things take, that people yeah. think they're just throwaway things yeah. or just a quick idea.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
But yeah, it was a great success. And I mean, sadly, Stephen is no longer with us. Stephen Malachat, who wrote it, he died of cancer quite young. But and Robin Herford, who directed it, still directs it in the West End and on yeah. tour and stuff.
What a thing.
I know. I mean, it's taken up, you know, well, that was 1987. So
it's coming on 30 years, I think, in the yeah. West End. Close
yeah.
enough.
Yeah, it will be.
But you've paid your dues in the West End.
A wee bit.
A wee bit.
Uh-huh.
How long did you do Mamma Mia?
2 years.
Two years.
Refer it to it as either my Swedish or my Greek national service.
yeah.
But yeah, no, it was a great show to be in. I wasn't in it right at the beginning. I joined in, I think, year three and stayed to the end of year four.
So does that mean it was all laid out for you and it was just a, you stand there now and this kind
of
thing?
Well, no, actually, it wasn't at that stage. I think that does tend to happen with long-running shows in the West End, particularly musicals, because there are so many moving parts. And once the main creative team, if you like to call them that, have moved on to other things, it's very much in the hands of associates and assistants, and they
also
have
if it ain't broke, I think
have a Bible that they follow, and you know the blocking stays pretty much the same. But that early in the process, they had been running for 2 years, and the three of us who played the dads in that in that production at that time all joined at the same time, and we all got on really well and became great mates. And we just kind of threw it about a bit. And initially, I think there was a little bit of, oh, I'm not sure. Oh, well, that's not what they're doing at the moment. And we said, well, we'll just try it. And we became known as the Bad Dads.
Because didn't do that?
No, we were being a bit naughty, coming in and shaking it up. but they liked what we were doing. So they said, oh, great, it's fine. Just let them get on with it. You know, it's great. And the only note we ever used to get was, just remember, you've only just met each other just before you come on stage.
Not two mates for life.
You haven't been mates for life. Because we were very close. It was lovely. And it was a joy to do. I mean, I'd never done anything like that before, you know. I'd done the odd musical, but I hadn't done a big West End musical, and certainly not one with that kind of oomph and immediate kind of appeal.
And that reputation as well. It's just it's sold already. Yeah. You just walk on there and it's done, right?
Yeah, I mean, we did a dress rehearsal to a full house in the Prince Edward.
Wow.
Which was, I think, 2,000 seats. Absolutely packed. The dress rehearsal, because we rehearsed up until I think the Thursday the week before. We had about 5 weeks rehearsal. The week before we opened on the Monday night, we had done a run through on stage tech dress thing with keyboard, bass, and drums, and then we didn't rehearse again until we did the dress rehearsal on the Monday, because they had two shows in there on the Friday, two on the Saturday. The theatre was dark on the Sunday, and then we went in Monday afternoon, and they'd just opened it up to
paper it for
people who worked in the West End, and it was still quite early in the show's run, so there were lots of people who hadn't seen it or wanted to see it again or had mates in it, and it was absolutely rammed, and I had to play the guitar One of the first things I had to do on stage in that show was play a guitar, and I had never played a guitar in my life before.
Oh my God.
So I had basically 5 weeks to learn Thank You for the Music, and I thought, well, that Thank You for the Music sounds like a nice jolly wee song. It'll be about four chords or something, you know.
I'm when sure you think of the chorus, that. You go, oh, four chords.
Yeah.
And then ABBA, you
But realize, actually, to play the chorus, I had to learn 19 different chord shapes on the guitar, including 19? Bar chords.
Gee whiz.
And I was, you know, I was like, well, I'll give it a go. In fact, in my last audition, I was all the way through the auditions, the assistant director was saying, have you played a guitar? I said, no, I haven't. He said, have you ever played a stringed instrument? I said, well, I used to play violin a wee bit when I was a kid,
yeah,
but only for 6 months or something. He said, no, well, it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be fine. I can teach you. I'm a guitarist, blah, blah, blah. And this went on all the way through. And I kept saying, are you sure it's going to be all right with the guitar? And he said, no, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. So my last audition for that show was on the stage, on the set. Mm-hmm. And we did scenes and sang and did all that. And as I was leaving the stage, Phyllo de Lloyd, the director, who was sat down in the stalls, called up and said, oh, Peter, by the way, she said, do you play the guitar? And I looked at her and I looked at Peter Addis, the staff director, and I looked back at her and I went, not yet, Phyllida. And she went, oh. And he ran down into the stalls and was having a very urgent conversation with her. And I looked up and Bjorn Ulvaeus was sat just over her shoulder. I thought, oh, that's it. I've lost the job.
Forget it.
Anyway, I left and he came back and said, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it. And anyway, then I had got the job, so it was fine. And I had a couple of lessons and spent 5 weeks playing for hours until my fingers were virtually bleeding.
Yeah.
And that was all fine, and I got through the dress rehearsal. And there was a sort of fallback thing where because sometimes the guitar would be out of tune because it was on the set and the set moved, and then I picked it up. And it was an old guitar, it was, you know, it could quite easily go out of tune. So the fallback was that if I tried to play the first chord and it didn't sound right, I would just look down at the MD and he would nod to one of the guitar players and they were poised to play it for me. So that was fine, and I would just mime it. I wanted to be able to play it, you know. I didn't want that to be...
No, of course you want, yeah.
So just about got through the dress rehearsal fine. It was okay, made a few mistakes. And then in the evening, of course, it was our official first performance, public performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used to get in the habit of going down to... There was a wee cupboard where the guitar was kept. I'd go down there and practice, you know, before the show, check it was in tune, blah, blah, blah. And I was in the cupboard... and with my guitar. And unbeknownst to me, the company manager was going around introducing Bjorn and Benny from ABBA to the entire company in the dressing rooms.
Is this the first night?
This was my first night, Monday. Yeah. So I'm sat in the cupboard and I'm playing the guitar and I'm thinking, oh, that's all right. And then this head came round the door and it was Bjorn Ulvaeus. And he went, oh, hi, Peter. How are you? Saw the show this afternoon and you're in great voice. Have a great show tonight. And I said, oh, thanks, Bjorn. He said, is it in tune? He said, and pointed at the guitar. And I went, yeah, I think it is. I think it is, Bjorn. Yeah, I think it is in tune. Yeah, I think it is. And he went, oh, that's great. I'll see you at the party after. Have a great night. And he went away and I thought, oh my God. And I started practicing again. We went through everything again. And then about 2 minutes later, another head, slightly shaggier head, came round the door. And it was Bjorn. Not Bjorn, Benny. Yeah. It was Benny. And he gave me a thumbs up and he went, hi, Peter, how are you? I went, I'm fine, thanks, Benny. He went, is it in tune?
God.
And I went, yeah, I think it is. I think it is. It's in tune. Yeah, I think it is. And he went, it never matters. Have a great night. And that was just a brilliant illustration of how different they were as, you know, personalities.
Yep.
Bjorn was very on it and very businesslike and, you know. And Benny was just so laid back, came to see the show, came to the party afterwards, got on the piano, you know, was...
Really? There was a second song?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Amazing.
So then you get to the end of a year of that. Do you have a big decision to make? They offer you another and you go...
Well, they offer it to you about 6 months in because they have to do a whole round of casting and everything else. And it was a very easy decision for me to make because we had just had our second son.
Right, of course.
So I started in the March. He was born in August. And in October, they said, we'd like you to stay. And I went, yes.
Instantly.
And we all three of us did. We all stayed together.
Oh, the three lads stayed.
The three lads stayed. And then I left after 2 years, and the other two stayed on.
Another year?
I think one of them did 4 years, and the other one did about five, I think.
Wow.
So, or left and came back. But I had sort of promised myself I would only do a second year. I thought if I go longer than that, I should really hand my equity card back and see. Yeah.
Just go over to the mousetrap.
Yeah. But I mean, that's a bit harsh because people do spend a long time in music. I didn't realise at the time, but, you know, friends of mine now, you know, there's one guy who's been in Phantom of the Opera since the beginning, I think.
No.
Yeah, he's still there.
I've got to interview him.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned the mousetrap. It's a great story, theatrical anecdote, about the woman who was understudying one of the parts in the mousetrap for years. She'd been in it for about 10, 15 years.
She was the longest serving understudy in history.
That's
16
right.
years,
but
I read
she turned up one night at the stage. She'd never been on. She'd turn up at the theatre and she'd sit in her dressing room, she'd do her knitting, whatever, and then she'd go home. And she turned up one night and the stage doorkeeper was there, all very excited, and said, "Oh, Donnie. She said, "You'll never guess." She said, You're on. She said, "What?" She said, "You're on." She said, "Am I?" She said, "Yes." She said, "Oh, I better just go and get my makeup from the car." And they never saw her again.
No way.
That's apparently true.
Said a runner.
Yeah.
She never learned it.
Well,
she's just thinking, I'll go on.
Yeah.
I've had that. I got asked to do an understudy thing 2 days into the run of the James plays. And
yeah.
I said, yeah, sure. Because I thought, I'll take the extra money and never going on.
Yeah.
This is a world tour. They're loving it.
And you did go on.
3 days later, I'm up there.
I remember you being
learning the lights. Yeah. Terrified.
Yeah.
Just terrified to put a foot wrong, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you say, these big machine productions.
I know.
They're not going to find you with a light. You've got to find it.
That's true. It is true.
You must have had some experiences where, on a smaller scale, you found different joys, though. Because sometimes some of those, what are they?
Well, certainly doing, you know, working with Alan in the Round in Scarborough, it was always a small theatre and you're very, very close to the audience. And so it's just a different kind of dynamic. And I've always enjoyed going from one to the other. I think I've always liked my next job to be very different in some way from the one before, not just in terms of the character you're playing or the style of the play, but also where you're doing it. It's nice to go in, if you've been playing a great big theatre, it's nice to go back into a little intimate space. There's lots of joy to be got from that. And just that, just refinding that thing of, or trying to find that sort of absolute central truth of a character or a scene or a situation, which of course has to be there when you're in a bigger space, but then there's a whole lot of technique that goes with sharing it with a bigger room.
The naturalism, if you like, is
it's
a different type of naturalism.
It is a different type, but it's the seed is the same, and the decisions you've made are the same, but the way you communicate it has to be slightly different in terms of technique. And if you do something for a long time in a big theatre, you can get to the point where you think, this doesn't feel real. It feels a bit hollow. It feels a bit, you know, I don't feel I'm filling this completely.
It's hard. Doing the same thing for a long time is hard.
Yeah.
To keep some of that.
To keep it fresh.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
Have you got a big routine of preparation on the day for a thing? Are you one of these come in at the half and have a coffee and run on type guys?
No, I'm somewhere in the middle. I mean, it depends on the show. Obviously, with something like Follies, I was very, very aware from the minute I woke up in the morning. The first thing you do is try and make a little bit of sound with your voice.
Make sure she's still going. And
sometimes you think, ooh, that's not too bad. And sometimes you think, I've got about 5 notes. Let's see how this goes over the next few. And then actually the main bit of preparation would be what I do in the morning in terms of, you know, steaming or drinking certain things, making sure you've got enough fluid in your system. I mean, they say it takes something like 4 hours for if you're drinking water, for that water to reach your vocal cords, as it were, to fully hydrate your system.
Gosh. So you want to be well in advance.
So there's no point in turning up going, I feel a bit dry. You know, I'll have a glug of water at the five or at the beginners. You need to be doing it all day, really. And just making sure you're getting enough fluid in you. And, you know, you start buying more expensive honey and all those stuff.
Gradually believing hype. Simon Callow said if you're feeling sprightly at the half, you should eat a pork pie.
Really? Just calm yourself down.
No, keep you going, just like so that you've got sustained energy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, the timing of when you eat.
It's important.
If you're doing
isn't it?
A show in the evening, it depends if it's a very physical show, if it's, you know, if you're singing, it's different from if you're just speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, my preparation's different for every show, mm-hmm. really.
Have you worked with a lot of people who have very different ways of doing things to you? Not just preparation, but do you ever find yourself working with closely with someone who's got a really different way of doing things?
Yeah, I did. I can remember one actor I worked with in a play where we were playing brothers, actually, which is quite interesting. We're playing brothers, and he came very much from a sort of drama centre, methody kind of background.
Mm.
And he was a very highly politicised guy as well. He was very, very serious. And when I first met him, I thought, oh. And people had said, you know, oh, he's very serious and, you know, he's a bit method and
right.
all that. And I thought, well, this would be interesting. And actually, I've always found that working, sometimes the best experiences are working with actors who have a very different approach to you.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it takes you out of your comfort zone and it also introduces you a bit to how they do things and you learn an
you
awful lot.
You pick stuff up.
You do pick
yeah.
stuff up. And you spark off each other in a different way.
Mm.
So it can be great. I mean, if somebody's so rigid in their process that, you know, they insist on working a certain way, I mean, that doesn't tend to happen, but sometimes directors will insist on working in a particular way.
Yeah.
You know, like we're going to action every line and we're going to, you know, work out what all the units are and everything. I mean, that's kind of common practice now, but sometimes I think, isn't this homework? Isn't this mm-hmm. my homework? I don't necessarily want to share all that with everybody. Around the table,
there's
all
a whole
the
part
time.
Of it that's
there is some
yours.
Of it that's incredibly useful.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think if you're sometimes, for my taste, if you're too slavish with it, it sort of kills the spontaneity and kills or can kill the spontaneity and can kill the exciting thing for me rehearsing a scene is when somebody says a line with a slightly different intention and the other actor immediately takes that and alters what they're doing. That to me is the excitement of acting. And back to Follies, one of the things we had was enough time in the rehearsal room to try lots of different options so yeah. that when you're on stage in front of an audience, you feel much freer. And if somebody changes something, you can respond
yeah.
in several different ways.
So it's alive in space.
It's really alive.
Mm.
And that's great, you know, because there are nights when you'll be playing a scene and you're kind of thinking, oh, this is, I'm just kind of coasting through this. And then the other actor will do something different and you go, what? Oh, right.
Really it wakes you up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. and it becomes a more enjoyable process. You know, it's a shared thing.
So you're going back into your own quiet little process for Peter May, back to the book.
Yes, doing another audiobook.
Do you just do that kind of... on your own, in your own way, or are you directed with that type
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah, well, it depends. Sometimes audiobooks are done, you know, sometimes people self-record them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just have an engineer
yeah.
who will, you know, pick you up on, oh, you're a bit off mic there, or can you,
yeah.
you fluff that line or whatever, and you have to monitor yourself as well. I'm fortunate with the books I do that I have a producer who does direct when she feels she needs to.
Yeah.
But also, she does a lot of the research for me as well. So things like Ooh. Pronunciations, because some of the books are set in places like Beijing.
Yes, yeah. And, I'm becoming aware of them increasingly.
Mm, and France, and a lot of his books are set in the Outer Hebrides, so there's wee bits of Gaelic, and I'm not a Gaelic speaker.
So you have someone dealing with that for you? That's
well,
nice.
She looks it all up and, you know, we've got the links, we can play them into the studio. Now with the internet, you know, you say, oh, I wonder how they say that in Stornoway. So you just
play,
you find it somewhere on YouTube or on some mm-hmm. library site somewhere that gives you pronunciations. But yeah, no, I mean, there's quite a lot of preparation goes into them. I always read the book just as a punter first and yeah. then go back through and mark it up, any notes that I need to make about who's speaking when and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Are you the exclusive purveyor of Peter May's work now,
well,
vocally?
I am at the moment because I did a few of his books and then he said he enjoyed my reading
mm-hmm.
and didn't really want anybody else reading his books because some of the ones that had been done before he wasn't very happy with.
Oh.
So now I'm actually in the middle of doing his whole back catalogue.
Oh,
so
I see.
While I was doing Follies, I've done about 5 or 6 books. And I've got another one to do next week. And then we're having a bit of a gap before we do some more later in the year.
How long do you take to do one?
It takes about 3 or 4 days in the studio,
mm-hmm.
Plus all the preparation and stuff.
gosh.
But yeah, it's quite tiring because you sat there for 6 hours a day just reading, you know.
Yeah.
With wee breaks and lunch break and stuff.
But and it's a dead little space as well, which can be quite odd to sit in for a long time.
Yeah, it can. I mean, I've got used to it now, but the first time I did it, I came out and at the end of the first day, I was like walking to the tube and I felt like I was snowblind.
Yeah.
Because I'd just been looking at this white page all day.
Gosh.
But yeah, like anything else, you develop a bit of stamina for it if you're doing it fairly regularly.
Well, it's a wee change from Follies anyway.
It is. It is.
I wish you well with it. Thank you very much for coming in to talk to me.
Thank you. It's lovely to talk to you.
There you go, the tremendous Peter Forbes. Brilliant to spend some time with him. Like I say, just focusing on the details of all that stuff. And he has such a fascinating process. And he's one of those actors that when I've worked with him, I have to remind myself that I'm in the play and pinch myself, because actually what I end up doing is watching him work. He's a powerhouse. And the consistency of a guy like that is really something to behold. Consistency, that's what I really notice. But a great guy. And after that interview, we managed to have a wee bit of dinner together. We went to see a show together. And, you know, he's so rarely up north and our paths don't cross that often. So that's another thing that this podcast has afforded me the opportunity to do is see people that I don't see that often, meet new people. And every time I go to the theatre and every time I go to gigs and things, I'm bumping into people. And I'm rounding up people. That's what I sometimes feel like when I'm going to theatre foyers. I think, I wonder who I'll see today. So I'm going to the theatre as much as I can, which I always do, but with a new head on, which is, you know, can I get these people in and get them on the podcast? And would people want to hear that? And invariably the answer is yes for both questions. So what a joy. What a pleasure. I'm off now to continue my work on my little retreat. And because I'm recording this in advance, I'm hoping for my future self that by the time this podcast comes out, I've done some tremendous work and I've made great headway with the thinkery. So keep your fingers crossed for me, which for you will be the me that's in the past. I don't know. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thanks for being part of it. Thank you so much for everything. Keep tweeting, keep sharing, keep liking. And remember that my website and my logo are done by my friends at purplepandamedia.com. They're the people to go to if you're looking for web design, logo design, graphic design. It's all there. purplepandamedia.com. Thanks to them. And thanks to you. And until next time, cheerio now.